Hello and welcome to Entwistle Partners' signature series, Your Story is Our Story. We are here to introduce you to the people behind entrepreneurship and philanthropy. My name is Kevin Entwistle and I will be your host today on Your Story is Our Story. We are jumping right into today's episode as I am sitting beside race director, philanthropist, speaker, and accomplished athlete, Dave McGillivray. Red Sox.
The highlight of this pregame program will be the entrance of David McGillivray.
David McGillivray, who is 24 years old.
He ran coast to coast to raise money for the Jimmy Fund.
Coast to coast run from Medford, Oregon to Medford, Massachusetts.
He has just run 80 days, averaging 43 miles a day. A Fenway Park greeting for Dave McGillivray.
When I crossed the finish line after my 3,452-mile run across the country, it was not just personal accomplishment, but there were people who finally gave me a chance in life. I want to teach other people that when they are being rejected by others or themselves, that there's always another avenue to take. And that's the sort of motto that I live by all my life.
From his extraordinary 1978 run across the U.S. to benefit the Jimmy Fund and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, to serving as technical director, then race director of the BAA Boston Marathon since the 80s, McGillivray has helped organize more than 900 mass participatory events since founding DMS Esports in 1981, while raising more than $50 million for various charities and logging more than 150,000 miles completing 155 marathons, which include 46 consecutive Boston marathons, with 31 run at night after his race director duties are fulfilled. Each year he runs his birthday age in miles, starting when he was 12 years old, which, by the way, he has not missed yet. Dave, we are so thankful to have you here today.
Kevin, thanks for having me. Boy, you've done your homework there.
And before we begin, here's a quick snapshot of the five can't-miss topics you can expect out of today's conversation. Being the last pick, Dave's 80 consecutive day run across the U.S., endurance events for charity, the Boston Marathon, or what some endearingly refer to as chasing unicorns, and maybe a few untold stories Dave will leave us with. So Dave, many times in our early lives, we have these individual, profound moments that ultimately shape us. Can you tell us what being the last pick was all about for you in your early days?
Sure. When I was a young boy growing up not too far from Boston in my hometown of Medford, Mass., I wanted to be one thing only, and I wanted to be an athlete. But unfortunately for me, I was short in stature. So anytime my friends would pick sides for teams, you know, in the playgrounds, I would always inevitably be the last pick. And that was frustrating. And then when I reached high school, when I went out for team sports, I seemed to always be the last one cut. So for me, I learned a valuable lesson about the concept of rejection. And that was pretty devastating. I've always felt there's three types of pain. There's physical pain, there's mental pain, and there's emotional pain, and the toughest of the three, at least for me, is emotional pain. So it was difficult to overcome the concept that nobody wanted you or nobody seemed to think there was value there, but that's when I started to run, because nobody can cut you from running, and I've been running ever since.
And tell us real quick, too, I know a lot of people have probably read your book, Last Pick, but you explained in the very beginning about playing other sports. I think it was basketball. And that to you, that wasn't really a sport in running, and it was something new that came to you and obviously ran with. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, again, always wanting to either play second base for the Boston Red Sox or guard for the Celtics. You know, again, growing up here in Boston, sports is something that's revered, and with all the amazing championship teams that we have come accustomed to, especially recently. So for me, I wanted to be part of that. And I would practice and train really hard when my friends would maybe be out in the woods doing things they shouldn't be doing. I was on the basketball court just shooting hoop. But again, unfortunately for me, it just wasn't meant to be, to be part of the team.
And it probably isn't meant for a lot of us growing up. We have those, you know, shared aspirations, but I'm really impressed with the way that you pivoted and ran with something. Just real quick too, childhood in Medford, what were your friends like? What was it like being Dave back then? Where did you draw your motivations from?
Again, for me, I mainly focused on health and fitness and athleticism. I spent the entire summer at the park, either playing basketball or playing baseball or playing tennis or running around. You know, it was just full of just sports. That's what my passion was. That's what drove me. But I also felt that was the same drive in everything I did. When I graduated from high school, I was number one in my class, valedictorian, not because I was the smartest kid in the class, but I had a hard work ethic. I knew that anything I attained, I had to work hard for, but then it meant even more when I was able to accomplish it. So everything for me later on in life began right then and there when I was growing up in my hometown. And I look at life as being a series of defining moments. When I was cut from my high school basketball team, I turned to the coach and I was really disappointed. And he looked at me and he said, "Dave, if you were 5 inches taller, you'd be my starting guard." I looked at the coach and I said, "Excuse me, coach, I thought it had to do with ability level, not how tall you were." So I challenged the center on the team to 1-on-1 to 21. He was 6'5", I was 5'4", and I beat him. I did. And I threw the ball off the court, and at the ripe old age of maybe 15, I said to myself then, again, another defining moment, that I will never, ever, ever allow anyone to tell me I'm not good enough, that I don't belong. And I remember I went home that night and I put a sign over my bed, and the sign said, "Please God, make me grow." And I look back on my life in retrospect and I said, well, maybe he didn't answer my prayer because I didn't physically grow, but maybe he did answer my prayer because I grew in other ways. And everyone can grow in other ways. You can grow morally and ethically and spiritually and intellectually and mentally and, most importantly, internally, because that's really where it's all happened, is who you are inside versus who you are physically.
And let's talk about some of that growth, too, in turning to my next question would be Medford to Medford, why you did that. So maybe just for the listeners real quick, explain what that was, that 80-day run, and some of that growth that you found in yourself.
Well, a friend of mine had biked across the United States from Medford, Mass. To Medford, Oregon, and I thought, well, if he can bike across, I can run across. Well, that was kind of a stretch. Obviously, biking and running are very different. But for me, I felt like in life, you always have to earn the right to do something. So I said, well, I'm going to make this commitment to myself, and then I'm going to earn the right to do it by doing the planning and the training. And then I'm going to tell my parents to seal the deal, and then I'm going to go out and do it. And I was working at the John Hancock Tower at the time, and I looked out the window. I saw Fenway Park, and I saw a sign out in right field. The sign said, "Help make a dream come true, support the Jimmy Fund." So I picked up the phone and I called the Jimmy Fund. A gentleman by the name of Ken Coleman answered the phone. Ken was the voice of the Boston Red Sox and the executive director of the Jimmy Fund. And I said, "Hi, Mr. Coleman, my name is Dave, and I want to run across the country for the Jimmy Fund." Well, after he picked himself up off the floor, he said, "You know, we'll support you, the Red Sox, and the Jimmy Fund will support your run." So then I went and I visited with the kids in the Jimmy Fund clinic, and I knew at the time that the battle that I was about to fight by running over 5.5 million footsteps across America was in no way as difficult as the battle that these kids are fighting for their own life. And I saw another sign in the Jimmy Fund clinic, and it said, "God made only so many perfect heads. The rest of them have hair on it." And I realized how fortunate I was to have my health, and these kids are turning negatives into a positive, and they're have the courage and the guts to sort of say, I'm going to get better. I'm going to work hard at it, and we're going to help them out. And that's why I ran across the United States.
And at the time, it didn't really seem like many people were doing this kind of thing. What were you hoping for, and what did you find out, you know, through doing this?
Well, yeah, you're right. I was probably the 7th person to run solo across the country, and I probably ran further than most people who had done it before me, because I went from Medford to Medford versus from, say, LA to Atlantic City. But again, it was just me trying to be an athlete. It was me challenging myself. And then it was about the concept of giving back. You know, I was very fortunate at that time in my life. I didn't have anyone in my family who was ill or had any physical challenges, but I still felt responsibility and an obligation to give back. So I remember reading in an issue of Runner's World magazine a couple of years ago that my run across the country in 1978 to raise money for cancer research was the first time someone had combined running with philanthropy, specifically with raising money for cancer research. So that's something I'm most proud of.
And can you take us through your itinerary, maybe some of the ups and downs, the long days, the short days?
Literally ups and downs. You know, it's funny because people say, what was the toughest part about running across the country? Was it the 120 degrees in the desert or running up and down 14,000 feet in elevation in the Rocky Mountains? And I said, no, neither one of them. The toughest part was the state of Pennsylvania because of the just the ups and downs and the ups and downs. 350 miles of undulating, you know, sort of roadway, and that really took its toll on me. But
I imagine there was no music either.
No, I mean, there was no cell phones, no iPods, no emails, no technology, no power bar food type products, cotton shorts and t-shirts and no tech gear. So it was pretty hardcore in terms of how I went and had to go about this. So my routine was very standard. I would wake up at 5:30 in the morning every morning. I had a motorhome and three guys supporting me. And we'd get up and I'd be out on the road at 6:30. I'd run 10-mile splits. So I'd run 10 miles, take a break. They'd drive the motorhome down the road 10 miles, wait for me. I'd get there, take a 10-minute break. Then run another 10 and take another break, another 10, another break, another 10, another break. And then at the end, I'd grab a cassette recorder and walk 2 miles, sort of just to wind down and record my thoughts of the day. So every day was exactly the same. And I never really felt like, you know, I couldn't get out the door. I dismissed any concept of, you know, weather deterring me from doing my mileage that day because I was on a schedule. I had committed to run 80 days. And I was supposed to finish on August 29th, 1978, inside Fenway Park in front of 32,000 people. And that's exactly what I did.
And can you share with us that probably overwhelming emotional experience of taking that victory lap? And I think it might have been 2 laps you took, right?
It was certainly and still remains the highlight of my athletic career. Not that people doubted me. Maybe some did, but it wasn't about me proving to anyone else, you know, something. It was me setting a goal, working hard, earning the right, and getting out there, accomplishing it, and doing some good in the process. The Red Sox said, come out of the left field wall, run 3/4 of the way around the warning track, end at home plate, say a few words to the crowd, and leave the field. And as I was running, the crowd was just on their feet, yelling and screaming. The ball players were yelling and screaming. The media was even yelling and screaming. And just, I never imagined it would be that boisterous. And I thought, well, heck, I just ran across the continent raising money for sick kids. Let's do another lap. You know, and I felt like I was going to continue. You know, they were going to call the police on me to pull me off the, off the field. Exactly. Yeah. It says, hey, buddy, we got to stop this game. But no, everybody really supported it, and it was a fitting end to a long journey.
Unbelievable end. And can you just speak to commitment? With somebody like you, people like to analyze everything about what makes you go, what makes you drive, and people want to extrapolate those characteristics for their own lives. So maybe just take all of 30 seconds to explain commitment to you and discipline, because you certainly have those characteristics.
I always feel when people ask me what my best accomplishment is, I always say my best accomplishment is my next one. And I truly feel that, you know, what's done is done. I want to take the rearview mirror out of my car and throw it away because I don't want to look back. I want to look forward. So I want to live for today and plan for tomorrow. So I'm always looking for that next challenge. And when people ask me, what do I want to be when I grow up? I always say one thing and one thing only. And I say, I want to be an accomplisher. I just want to accomplish things. It doesn't matter so much as to what, but the fact that I set a goal, worked hard, earned the right, and accomplished it and move on to the next one. So commitment to me is an interesting concept because I don't commit to anything, again, unless I first feel like it's within my reach. And then once I feel like, okay, I want to do this, then I tell those who are most important to me that I've committed to doing this, and that kind of seals the deal. And then lucky for me that 99% of the time I'm able to get out there and get it done.
Let's talk a little bit more about some of these accomplishments as it relates to the philanthropy side. We talked about how you were one of the first ones to start getting involved with running and fundraising. When we look at it today, what's drawn so much attention, one, to just marathons, to half marathons, to 5Ks, and what is drawing so much attention also to the fundraising aspect?
Well, back in the, when I was running in the late 60s, early 70s, and even the 80s, the sport was just that, a sport, and very, very competitive. Only those who really committed to compete on the road actually participated. And then, interestingly, the walls of intimidation crumbled. Philanthropy, in my opinion, was the watershed moment when people started thinking that they wanted to participate for a greater purpose than themselves. So a lot of charities started putting teams together, and people used that as their motivation to get off the couch, to do some training, and to get into the game. Instead of being a spectator, they now became a participant. So it exploded, and that's what you're seeing today. The beauty about the sport or the activity is now that you have the competitive side along with the philanthropy side, and they can very well coexist. You know, there's probably not a road race out there in America today that doesn't benefit some worthwhile cause. And I think that's a good thing. It brings a whole new market to the industry. It makes people believe in themselves, because I think once they make the commitment and they participate in one event, they're committed for life. It's a life-changing experience, and that's why you see in races now, you know, selling out at record pace.
And I want to give you a chance to speak about DMSE as well. I know you founded that yourself. What is your team doing today to combine athletics and philanthropy? What are you guys working on? Any new projects?
So when I started the business almost 40 years ago, people looked at me like I had three heads, and like, you think you can earn a living by putting on road races? And I said, well, that's where you're wrong. I'm not just putting on road races. My epiphany or my vision was, down the road, people are going to get it. You know, facetiously, when I was asked what I did for a living, I would almost mumble, I'm a race director. They're like, what? What do they do? You know, chalk mark in the road and yell go. And now when people ask me what do I do for a living, I say I help raise the level of self-esteem and self-confidence of tens of thousands of people in America. So really what I think the majority of what this sport and this activity is all about is to make people feel good about themselves. I always say that the toughest part about running in a race, in particular a marathon, is signing the application. And then once you sign it and you do the work and you toe the line, you answer the gun and you run the course and you cross the finish line and you get a medal, magic happens. You go home feeling good about yourself. And there's nothing more important in life than that. And that's the very foundation by which we accomplish anything in life, is to first feel good about yourself. So that's sort of what I think this business is all about for me anyways. And I'm fortunate that I have surrounded myself with a lot of good people, a good team, and we've managed now, you know, almost 1,000 events all over the country, everything from being consultants on the Olympic Games to Goodwill Games to World Championships to the Boston Marathon to races all over the country and all over the world.
And we'll get into some more of that in maybe 5 or 10 minutes, but just real quick, wrapping up on this topic, what do you see as the next 10, 20 years, your vision for this sport or activity running?
Well, that's a great question. If I had the answer, I'd go run off right now and play the lottery. You know, it's interesting, Kevin. Years ago, I could almost tell you day by day what was going to happen in this industry. I could predict it. It's very different now. It's going in a lot of directions. You know, people are participating for a lot of different reasons, and there are a lot of different type of events, the off-road, you know, military style, Spartan races, Tough Mudder, you know, things of that nature that are not on the open road, but, you know, on the trails or crawling through the mud, or, you know, climbing walls. again, whatever makes somebody get off the couch, all I want to do is just to keep people moving more than anything else. So where it's all heading, I do still think it's the tip of the iceberg. As much as the world I live in, it looks like, oh my goodness, there's a lot of people doing this. Just recently in the London Marathon, they opened registration for the 2020 event, and almost 500,000 people applied for 50 or 60,000 spots. I mean, that's unfathomable in terms of years and years ago, and that's how many people want to be part of this. So I think there are even more exciting times down the road.
And I would agree too. I think there's so many different races coming out, but the history behind some of the races like London or Boston or New York continues to draw that appeal, and it probably will draw more people as the years come.
Yeah, I think so. The iconic events like the World Marathon Majors or races like the New Balance Falmouth Road Race or the TD Beach to Beacon are races that have been around for a while and that have all the ingredients, have the elite athletes, have the community support, have the sponsorship, you know, are in great locations, great venues. Those are going to be around forever. There's such a proliferation, though, of events that some of them are sort of chipping away at others. So everyone's vying for their space, if you will. But, you know, at the end of the day, still, there are more people participating today, each and every day, than there was yesterday. So that's a good thing.
And we are sitting in the Warrior Ice Arena now in Boston, Massachusetts. I took a train up from New York to speak with Dave, and we are going to talk a little bit about Patriots Day. And for some of those folks who don't know what it is, it happens every year on the third Monday of April. And I wanted to ask Dave to start this off is what this event, what this day means to you.
Well, again, when I was growing up at the young age of 17, I heard about the Boston Marathon, mainly listening to it on the radio back then, back in 1972. And I just sort of had this feeling that I wanted to do it. So I called up my grandfather, who lived in Brighton, not too far from where we are here, and I said to him I was going to run in the race, and he said he'd meet me at Coolidge Corner. And I said, where's that? He said, 24 miles. I said, okay, I'll see you there. And my brother drove me to the start. And long story short, I took off. And I just didn't earn the right. So I dropped out on the hills in Newton and got taken to the Newton Wellesley Hospital in an ambulance and got home and called my grandfather. And he didn't answer. Finally, 9 o'clock at night, he answered the phone. And I said, where have you been? He said, Dave, where have you been? The old man, Kelly, goes by, the street sweepers go by, no Dave. And I said, well, I failed. I quit. He goes, no, you didn't quit. I said, what I do? He said, you learned. I said, great. What I learned? You learned you cannot go along in life and set reckless goals. You know, you really didn't deserve to be in that race. I said, you're right. He says, I'll cut another deal with you. I said, what's that? He said, if you train for it, I'll be there waiting for you next year. And I said, fine. Well, 2 months later, he died. And I said, I got to do this in memory of my grandfather. And so I trained and I entered and I was 18 and I was running 120, 130 miles a week and I was ready to go. And the day before I got sick, my parents said, you can't run. I said, I have to run. The newspapers are saying, Dave, running in memory of your grandfather. So they let me run and I took off. And, you know, I was suffering the whole time. And at 21 and a half miles, I dropped out again. So it was really another defining moment for me because I get cut from all the teams. I'm the last pick. I drop out of my first Boston, drop out of my second Boston. I just said, I guess being an athlete is just not in the cards for me. And another defining moment. And I turned around and I had dropped out right in front of the Evergreen Cemetery. And that's where my grandfather was buried. And I could see his tombstone. And that son of a gun said he'd be there waiting for me. And maybe he wasn't there physically, but I looked at it as he was there spiritually, and I thought, he kept his end of the deal. I got to keep my end of the deal, and I picked myself up, and I finished that race in 1973, my first marathon, my first Boston Marathon in 4.5 hours, and I said on that day that I would run this race every year for the rest of my life in honor and tribute of the lesson my grandfather taught me about earning the right to do this stuff, and I've run it for the last 47 years.
That's a remarkable story, and it's been continues to be a story for you. And you spoke a little bit earlier about growth and about inner peace and finding yourself. Are you still the same Dave that you were you know, those days by the Evergreen
Cemetery, yeah.
Or do you find yourself constantly, like you said, trying to remove the rearview mirror and move forward? Who are you today versus earlier?
Oh, I think the core of who I was is still who I am. I haven't changed at all in terms of I truly believe we're all in this thing together. I'm no more special or better than anyone else. For me, a lot of people say, why do you keep doing this? And I sort of have just a two-word answer. Be relevant. I just want to be relevant. In other words, what do you got for me lately? I just don't want to talk about the past. I want to talk about the present. And so, yeah, if I can help, you know, motivate, inspire others to follow their heart, follow their passion, be an accomplisher, and then at the same time, you know, maybe help raise some money for some important, worthwhile causes, then I think I fulfilled my mission on this earth.
And for those who want to be accomplishers at the Boston Marathon, you either have to qualify or raise money. Talk us through the course, the layout, the iconic, you know, the nature of it that is so special and brings so much to Patriots Day that we've come to expect.
I think there's a lot of reasons for the draw of the Boston Marathon. Certainly, you know, we just finished our 123rd running. People say to me, so you're the race director? And I said, yeah, you could say that, but I'm really just a caretaker. It was here about 90 years before I took over as the race director, and it'll be here a lot longer after I'm gone. I'm just taking care of it for a while. Not a lot has changed. Same course, same day. You know, maybe the field size is the thing that's the factor that has changed the most. And then just every race, I guess, has its own characteristics. And Boston's no exception in terms of starting in a small rural town of Hopkinton. The starting line's only 39 feet wide. You know, we have no more real estate to do business today than they had 100 years ago when they had 100 people in the race. Now we have 30,000. And how do you manage that? The downhill nature of the course and the early going, and then, you know, going through Wellesley and Wellesley College girls cheering on all the runners, and then taking the turn onto Commonwealth Ave and up and over the famed Heartbreak Hill, and then running by the other iconic jewel in this city, Fenway Park, and then finishing on Boylston Street, right on Herefordth, left on Boylston. There's a lot of different segments of this race that, you know, really resonate with people who are running in it. You know, the qualifying standards, I think, separate this race from any other marathon in the world, where it's become the holy grail. The Super Bowl, the Stanley Cup, the World Series, the Kentucky Derby, the Tour de France of marathoning throughout the world. This is where people want to get. So as one of the people involved in the management side, i.e. the race director, I feel we have a strong obligation to deliver the best possible experience for those who are coming here from all over the world.
And you're very humble, you won't admit it, but planning an event like this, you've done it for many years, but I imagine it's still just as hard the next year. You're trying to stay relevant. And you even mentioned you don't want to set reckless goals. I mean, planning an event for 30,000 people, what goes into this each year, and does it change?
Well, we're always looking to improve. The beauty about Boston is that so much of it is done at the highest possible standard already, that it gives us the opportunity to take other pieces of it, put it under a microscope, and really elevate the standard and raise the bar. So we're constantly trying to set the standard in the industry for all the different aspects that make up this event and make up a marathon event. People say to me all the time, must be a lot of pressure to stand in front of 30,000 people and manage that. And my typical response is, yeah, but pressure is a privilege as long as you're prepared. And so the idea is to surround yourself with good people. One of the greatest assets of the Boston Marathon and the BAA is just the experience of those who are involved. I mean, people have been doing this for 20, 30, 40 plus years. You can't replicate that anywhere in the world, almost any event. So we're very fortunate that we have such a quality, experienced team. So, yeah, some of it is add water. You have soup, you know, get the eraser, change the date. But a lot of it isn't, because you still have to go through the motions. Managing or running a race is not a lot different than running in the race. Even if you've run 100 marathons, you can't fake it. You have to still do the training for the next one. And the next one might be just as challenging and just as difficult as the first one. You know, no one gets away unscathed. You still have to do the work.
Well, I definitely want to talk a little bit, wrapping up here, about you and maybe some stories. But I know if you're comfortable sharing, too, with some of your recent surgery. And I read something that you mentioned. It was the hardest Boston you've run yet, the most recent one. Would you be willing to share some?
Sure. Around 5 or 6 years ago, I was out for a run, and I could feel some discomfort in my chest, and my breathing was labored. And I just chalked it up as maybe something I ate the day before, or I didn't get enough sleep, or I tied my shoes the wrong way, whatever, and dismissed it somewhat. But it was persistent and kept rearing its ugly head for every single workout for months and months and months. And I said, this isn't right. I should probably get this checked. So I went to Mass General Hospital, and they did a battery of tests, echocardiograms to check my heart, pulmonary tests to, you know, check my lungs, and just EKGs and stress tests and nuclear stress tests and just about everything. And they didn't find anything. And I was like, whoa, whoa, you know, there's still something wrong here. And you got to give me the big boy tests, you know, look under the hood a little more here, folks. And so they did a CAT scan and an angiogram, and the doctor come in and he's like, there, and there. And I said, like, there what? And he says, you have severe coronary artery disease. And I said, how can I have that? I've run 150,000 miles. You know, I've run across the continent a couple of times. How did this happen? He said, I don't know, but you have it. So I came to the conclusion that it was a combination of genetics and maybe self-inflicted, that maybe I broke some of the rules myself in terms of diet and not getting enough sleep and stress and all that. So I decided to change everything, and I did, and I reversed my own severe coronary artery disease by about 30-40%. Went back to Hawaii, did the Ironman again for the first time in 25 years, and I thought I beat it. And then I went and did the World Marathon Challenge, which is running 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents last February. And, you know, I felt okay then. I didn't feel any discomfort, but when I got back, I could feel it again. And I thought, what the heck is this? I thought I beat this. And I realized that, you know, that something was wrong. And I went and had another angiogram, and they found some severe blockage in my main artery. And that's when it was determined that I had to have open heart surgery. So 6 months before this year's Boston Marathon, I met with my heart surgeon, and I said to him, I have one question to ask you. I said, this little race in April in Boston, I said, any chance I can shuffle through it? And he's like, well, he didn't say yes, and he didn't say no. He said, I'd be extremely disappointed if you couldn't. And that's sort of the nugget I needed. I need a little ray of hope that, you know, I could get through the surgery and get myself back on the road. And I did. And I ran this year's Boston Marathon at night, as I have for the last 32 years. And even though it was difficult and it was my slowest marathon ever, I guess you could say it was my most satisfying one, because it wasn't about being an athlete as much as it was about celebrating life, and that I was able to get a second chance and still do what I love to do.
And you run with a group that night too. I know you've spoken a few times today about community and people surrounding yourself with. What was that like to have a group with you?
Yeah, usually I have just a couple of friends run, but this time it was a little different. About 9 friends who did the World Marathon Challenge with me flew in from all over the country and supported me. And, you know, again, it was one of those things where, you know, not only is it a team effort to manage a race, but it can be a team effort to run in one too. I've always felt there's no such thing as an individual accomplishment, that there's always others there to help you achieve your goals. And this was a perfect example of that.
And who have been your role models? I know you spoke about your grandfather, but just anybody that you look up to these days? Is it yourself? Is it chasing the next thing that you spoke about?
Role models are interesting. It's an interesting phenomenon. I've always felt like in life I never idolize someone in a sense of like, I want to be just like that person because I want to be me. What I do feel is this incredible sense of respect for people accomplishing extraordinary things and knowing that it didn't come easy, that they worked hard to accomplish what they did. You know, if they were role models, it was more family-based, you know, parents, and even now it's my own children. They may think I'm their role model, but what they don't realize is they are my role model. I get my energy from them, you know, supporting me and encouraging me and just being good kids. So it's all about, for me, it's about mutual respect.
Thank you for that answer. And we'll wrap up on one last question here, but anything that I wasn't able to touch on or something that you wanted to share with people, something that you want to instill in other runners and other philanthropists or people who want to start their own company, what's one thing you just really want to
do? Well, now, for me, I'm on a new mission. The mission is about awareness, you know, mainly about heart illness, and that just because you're fit doesn't mean you're healthy. I always thought it did. You know, again, lucky for me, I was able to catch it. You know, there's a public safety campaign, again, here in Massachusetts, that if you see something, say something. And I feel, if you feel something, say something, that we need to advocate for our own health. You know, the most important person on the planet is you. You have to treat yourself that way or you're not going to be able to help someone else. And that anyone listening to this, we have something in common, and that is we woke up this morning. You know, not everyone else did. And for the most part, we didn't have a lot to do with it, but we do have a lot to do with what happens for the rest of the day. So the idea is to take care of yourself and make a difference.
Thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing some of your insight and experiences. It's been wonderful speaking with you. And we can't wait to see what the next one in store is for you. So we'll stay tuned on your relevancy and everything you're doing. So thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you all for tuning into this episode. Please feel free to leave a comment or tag a friend who might be interested in learning more. If anyone is interested in hearing more about Dave, be sure to check out his company website, DMSE, or find him on social media. He has much more to share. Have a great day, and we will be back with more entrepreneurs and philanthropists soon. Thanks for listening.